Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from BU Questrom School of Business. Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of a recent episode exploring the history of investors holding businesses accountable and the dawn of the ESG, or Environmental Social Governance, movement.
I've signed a historic piece of legislation here in the United States that includes the biggest, most important climate commitment we have ever made in the history of our country.
President Biden set the goal: cut U.S. carbon emissions in half by 2030.
So let this be the moment we find within ourselves the will to unlock a resilient, sustainable, clean energy economy to preserve our planet.
Achieving that goal will require vast amounts of lithium.
This lithium deposit is one of the richest ones in North America.
Copper.
We are at probably an inflection point in the annual demand for copper.
Cobalt.
The only way to survive in that part of the Congo is to pick up a strip of rebar or their bare hands and start digging in pits for cobalt because it's everywhere.
Nickel.
And if you're looking at a Ford F-150 Lightning, you know, we're looking, I think, almost at about 180 pounds of just nickel in that battery.
Each element serves a different purpose, but they all have one important thing in common.
Without mining, there will not be a clean energy transition.
But increasing mining to meet our clean energy needs comes at a cost.
If we're going to be using these materials, we need to, first of all, be honest with ourselves and be more aware.
Especially if you look at the environmental and social costs of becoming a smelting and mining and battery hub to the world.
It's not up to you to decide what to do with this land. This is their land. This is their ancestral land, and they don't want this to happen.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is an On Point special series.
There is no math about the new demand for these minerals.
All the mining companies, they're billionaires, and we're still poor, destitute, struggling.
The most negative story you could tell, the worst assumptions you could project.
To take the lithium out of this ground is another form of genocide or cultural genocide.
Still, it's going to be a vast, vast, vast improvement on the ongoing apocalypse that is the fossil fuel economy.
Elements of energy, mining for a green future. Episode 2. The Copper Trade-Off. Ernest Scheider is author of The War Below: Lithium, Copper, and the Global Battle to Power Our Lives. He's got our Copper 101.
Copper is one of the best electricity conducting metals, and it's used across the global economy so much that it's been given the nickname Dr. Copper, because the price for this reddish metal is seen as a barometer of global economic health.
But Dr. Copper can also make the land sick. In the heart of Panama, along the Caribbean coastline, lies one of the most biodiverse rainforests in the world. It's home to more than 2,000 different species. And at 13,000 hectares, it's almost as large as the entire city of Miami. But since 2019, instead of lush jungle, this area is now Cobre Panama, one of the largest open pit copper mines in the world.
So
with the building of this project, you had 100 square meters, you had 2,000 species, and now you only have rock. Before that was all green and full of life.
Isaiah Ramos is a biologist at the Environmental Advocacy Center of Panama. His colleague, Joanna Abrigo, serves as his translator. Canada-based First Quantum Minerals runs Cobre Panama. The $10 billion operation produces 1.5% of all the world's copper. It provides 7,000 jobs and generates 5% of Panama's GDP. But most Panamanians want the mine to go. Last year, the Panamanian government quietly and quickly extended First Quantum's contract for 20 years, with terms highly favorable to the company.
Panama
Panamanians took to the streets in the largest nationwide protest there in almost 40 years. For weeks, roads closed, schools shut down, supermarkets emptied. One of the protesters spoke with Canadian TV station W5.
I think that this will be an unstoppable war. If they take our lands and contaminate our rivers, what will we live off? What will we leave our family members and our children? We are fighting for that mine to be shut down. We know it won't happen overnight, but we want it to end.
In 2021, an inspection by Panama's Environment Ministry found more than 200 infractions, including battery acid contamination in the soil and the illegal discharge of waste into the sea. Biologist Isaiah Ramos, again with Joanna Abrigo, translating.
There was no continuous monitoring of the advances for the community. It's a colonial scheme in the area. The relationship between the company and the community is almost colonialism.
Ramos says given Panama's history with colonialism, people were no longer willing to tolerate being ignored by their own government and a Canadian corporation.
The message was rather simple. It was, Panama is worth more without mining. Panama is green, the true gold of Panama is green.
Last fall, Ramos's group, the Environmental Advocacy Center of Panama, brought suit against First Quantum's contract. And late November, Panama's Supreme Court ruled that the new mining contract violated 25 articles of the country's constitution, including the right to live in a pollution-free environment, the obligation of the state to protect children's health, and its commitment to promote the economic and political engagement of indigenous and rural communities. On November 28th, President Laurentino Cortizo ordered the Cobre Panama mine closed. However, it may not remain permanently closed. First Quantum is claiming the closure is an alleged breach of a Canada-Panama free trade agreement. It intends to take Panama to international arbitration. And investors have filed at least three lawsuits against Panama itself. The company says closing the mine properly could take 10 to 15 years and cost $1 billion. And then there's the possible blow to the world's clean energy future. According to First Quantum, Panama's mine generates enough copper for 6 million electric vehicles or 10,000 large wind turbines every year. That's the copper trade-off. Biologist Isaiah Ramos says he supports green energy, but questions, at what cost and who must pay for it?
How much of our unique natural ecosystems we have to sacrifice to satisfy the needs of the first world? Our country is not responsible for the emissions. Actually, our country is emission negative. But even considering the current climate crisis, how much we have to continue sacrificing so someone can have an electric car? Para que alguien tenga un carro eléctrico.
Biologist Isaiah Ramos with his colleague Joanna Abrigo helping to translate. Well, joining us now is Michael Weber. He's professor of mechanical engineering and energy resources at the University of Texas in Austin. Professor Weber, welcome to On Point.
Thanks so much for having me. I look forward to the conversation.
So first of all, explain what role does copper play exactly in our green energy future? What do we need it for?
Well, copper is really valuable as an electrical conductor and a thermal conductor. So it's really good at moving electrons around and really good at moving heat around. If you think about wind turbines or solar panels or batteries or just an expanded electrical grid, it needs a lot of ability to move electrons around and to manage them properly. And copper is a great material for that. It's also pretty easy to turn into wires or sheets or strips and easy to handle. So it's just a really good material for what we need with clean energy.
You know, that first question was almost the most obvious one, right? Because copper is one of the oldest elements that humankind knows of that moves electrons around, right? Many of us still live in homes that have copper wire lingering in the walls. But why is it that we're still so reliant on it? I mean, can we imagine a future with those wind turbines or electric vehicles that would find something else other than an increased consumption of copper to power those pieces of technology.
I mean, there are better conductors like gold that are more expensive or rarer, and there are cheaper materials, different metals like aluminum that also work, but they don't work quite as well. So it's always a trade-off between performance and cost, abundance, ease of use, and things like weight as well. Aluminum is really light, but doesn't conduct as well. So copper is just really good. Nature made in a way that's really handy for the things we'd like to use it for, especially as we grow the need for electricity. Think of all the video games and data centers and that kind of thing.
You know, we keep talking about electric vehicles in this series because I think it's just one area that's very easy for people to understand why we might need more mining to help create more electric vehicles. I'm seeing here that EVs can use, 170 pounds of copper in each vehicle, which is quadruple the amount used in an internal combustion engine.
Yeah, think of like a typical gasoline car might have like 50 pounds or a little less of copper inside of it. So that's one thing to keep in mind is the conventional system also uses a lot of copper. We use copper already for society, and we're just talking about using more copper for the cleaner version of society. My electric vehicle, which I own or other people have, will have something like 170 to 200 pounds. So it's like a quadrupling, as you said, of the copper. And that's significant. However, it means I don't have to use gasoline, and I use something like that much weight of gasoline every 3 months. So I will extract more mass of copper from the earth to make the battery and let the electric vehicle go and that kind of thing, and also for the motor inside the electric vehicle. But then I won't have to extract from the earth that many pounds of gasoline to fuel the car. So it's a trade-off in terms of mass or tonnage extracted from the earth that pays back within a couple of months.
Okay. Now, we started with a quick look at what's happening in Panama with the Cobre Panama mine. We've just got a short bit of time before our first break, Professor Weber. First of all, it's impossible to truly fathom how large that mine is. I mean, the mine is the size of the city of Miami. I mean, is that typical for copper mines?
That's a big mine, but mines are that big. And you can sometimes see them from space, or if you fly over mining areas, you'll see it from your airplane window. These are massive, massive operations. And obviously, there's a lot of topographic impact right there. Like, it's disturbed the land at the mine. But then when you include all the runoff and air pollution and other things, the impact can be even larger.
Well, Professor Weber, stand by for a moment. When we come back, we're going to learn in more detail exactly what those environmental impacts are and whether copper mining can be done more responsibly, given that, as you've said, we cannot imagine a green energy future without it. Elements of Energy continues in just a moment.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/onpoint. That's Indeed.com/onpoint. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken? A podcast from BU Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes.
ESG, or environmental social governance, challenges businesses to think beyond the immediate bottom line. But before ESG, the Balanced Scorecard did something similar. Questrom's Eddie Riedel explains.
The big thing that was groundbreaking about the Balanced Scorecard is really this idea to move beyond thinking about financial statements, which everybody had thought about since the 1920s, right? That was kind of the gold standard for how to evaluate a company and its performance. And the Balanced Scorecard's big insight, I think, was to get companies internally to think about, well, what if you don't just focus on financial measures? There are other things that are going to affect your performance, and maybe they won't affect them today, but they're going to affect them in the short term, midterm, long term. Building in those other criteria, those other dimensions, and explicitly linking that to your strategy, to how your company is going to operate, what kind of big decisions it's going to make, that's really what the big insight of the Balanced Scorecard was meant to do. And at the time, right now, it doesn't seem particularly revolutionary. It seems kind of obvious. We've been stuck in the ESG movement for a while, and thinking about linking these things to corporate strategy seems pretty obvious. At the time, it was a pretty big whoa kind of moment.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.
You're back with On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and today is episode 2 of our special week-long series, Elements of Energy, Mining for a Green Future. Our focus today is on the copper trade-off, or preserving today's lands versus protecting tomorrow's climate. And Michael Weber is with us. He's at the University of Texas in Austin. And Professor Weber, couple quick questions to help us better understand the environmental impacts of copper mining. So first of all, with Cobre Panama still at the front of our minds, is most of copper mining around the world done via that large-scale open pit mining?
One thing that's interesting about copper is how concentrated its sort of production is and controls, even more concentrated than, say, oil production. Two countries, Chile and Peru, are responsible for more than a third of global copper production, for example. So you have these very large mines, and they're often open pit, or these mines that are open from the top. You can see them. Think of the old days where people would build a tunnel to go into the land to get the mine, like Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs. They would go into these little tunnels. And that's a different approach. You either remove the copper from the mountain or remove the mountain from the copper. And these days, we remove the mountain from the copper. Like, we remove the land to get to the copper. That's typically cheaper and actually safer for the workers, but very disturbing to the land, as you can imagine.
Right.
And they can be quite large.
Yeah, I mean, in Panama, it's basically just erased the area that was forest, right? So the obvious impacts to land and habitat are there. Are there any other sort of water or air impacts to the act of pulling the copper ore out of the ground before we even talk about processing?
Absolutely. So the three environmental categories are land, water, and air. That's what you have to worry about. And the land disturbance is visual. It's really easy to see. It's obvious. They remove the land. And so that means also impacting the biodiversity at the surface of the land, plus also in the subsurface. So there's some very big impacts there. The water impacts are also significant in some cases, because when it rains, water trickles through the mine or through the land and picks up some heavy metals or the minerals and gets into the waterways and can pollute the downstream rivers or different water bodies. That's a concern. And you also have to worry about dust or pollution from the equipment affecting the airshed. So people downwind might also get pollution. And sometimes to manage the dust, you might add water to the ground to keep the dust from getting in the air. And then that increases the risk of the water pollution. So some of these things are in tension with each other, but very impactful without a doubt. The part you don't see that we hope in the copper enables, though, is avoided pollution somewhere else. Mm. And so Panama or wherever the mine is gets more air, land, and water pollution right there. But then where I'm using my electric vehicle, I don't have the tailpipe pollution there. So someone in Miami has less air pollution for a mine the size of Miami and Panama getting more pollution. This is the trade-off that makes it very complicated, because the winners and losers aren't the same people always, and they're in different locations.
So then let's move to the actual process of separating the elemental copper from the copper ore, because I've read that the technology has gotten so good that the ore can contain as little as 10% copper, meaning that 90% of it has to somehow be separated, which is hugely water intensive, right? And also chemically intensive. How does that process happen?
Yeah, so there's mechanical inputs like grinding and crushing. There's heat inputs, there are chemical inputs, there are water inputs. All of these inputs cost money, but improve your yield of how much you get out. And all of them have a downside requirement of you had to buy energy from someone. And was that energy, or maybe produced on site, was that energy produced in a clean way? Where are you getting the chemicals from? How are they made? And what's the runoff or the downstream impacts of the chemicals, everything else? So all these inputs have a cost and a trade-off. And over time, copper mining and extraction and separations all gets better. So that's the good news, but it's still intensive. And if we're talking about quadrupling global copper output, it's going to be impactful. There are new technologies out there. There's a startup called Sabo that we looked at that has a new way to leach out the minerals, because there's like copper oxides and copper sulfides. And so there's different ways the copper is contained in the seams or in the mines. And so you need different processes to separate it out. And I think there should be pressure to clean it up, because it's pretty dirty, but copper sure does enable some clean lifestyle downstream, which is nice.
But tell me a little bit more, like what kind of chemicals are used to separate the actual elemental copper from the ore, and what are the dangers of the waste products produced there?
Yeah, and I don't have all the chemicals in my head right now, so okay. I don't remember right now. And I'm just sort of a dumb mechanical engineer, so I use hammers and wrenches instead of chemicals. But I'd call it, but they're pretty harsh chemicals acids and like that to leach out the copper. Then you get these tailing ponds or mining tails that are pretty gross that you have to contain. Unless you have a flood or runoff or the dam breaks and the ponds break, then you get it downstream. But it's pretty harsh stuff, right? These aren't just your cleaning chemicals at home to keep your windows clear. It's more intense than that. Industrial chemicals that take a lot of energy to make and then have a lot of downstream risk for sure.
Mm. You know, it's so fascinating how complex the copper mining process and smelting process is, because you mentioned Chile, one of the world's top suppliers of copper. You know, they've also got a long-term drought that they're dealing with. I'm seeing here that one of the major copper mines in Chile, in order to get around that drought, is building its own desalination plant. So, you know, I appreciate you going through step by step what copper mining entails, right? So now we have a clear view in our minds of, okay, well, here are the major environmental costs, right? Just the land surface, as you said, or removing the mountain to get to the copper, the potential water impacts, air impacts, biodiversity impacts. So that leads us to this question of, if copper is so critical to our green energy future, excuse me, Professor, is there a better way to mine it? So let's take a look at one possible example. And interestingly, we're going to turn to one of the biggest mining companies in the world to understand what could be coming down the line. So Sarah Macoumbe is the Sustainability Certifications Manager at the UK-based company Anglo American. Many of you might already have heard of it. It is one of the largest mining companies in the world. They have mines many places around the world, producing vast amounts of platinum, diamonds, nickel, and of course, copper. And in 2023 alone, Anglo American's revenues topped $30 billion. Now, Macoumbe says since 2005, the company has made efforts to mine more responsibly.
Mining as an industry has lost credibility due to events that have happened that result in social and environmental impacts and harm. And for mining companies to mark their own homework, you know, we don't have that credibility anymore.
So in 2008, Anglo American joined other mining companies, customers, trade unions, community and environmental groups, and NGOs to establish universally accepted responsible mining standards. But here's the catch. An independent third party, not the mining companies themselves, would be doing the auditing to see if the mines are living up to these established standards. That third party is called IRMA, or IRMA, the Initiative for Responsible Mining Assurance. Their standards are more than 400 pages long. They include everything from emergency preparedness, workers' rights, environmental impact, to noise control. Again, Sarah Macoumbe of Anglo American.
As an international company with operations in many jurisdictions, we wanted to find a solution that would be feasible to implement across our commodity mix. But I think more than that, we also wanted the credibility of the standard to be a factor we consider, because you don't want to do all of this effort and it's not acknowledged perhaps to the customers you want to sell to for, you know, its credibility.
Now, in many cases, the word credibility is simply corporate jargon for public relations. And granted, multi-billion dollar mining companies can be masters of PR. But in this case, the Initiative for Responsible Mining Assurance does carry the imprimatur of groups such as the United Steelworkers, Human Rights Watch, and the environmental advocacy group Earthworks. They all serve on IRMA's board. So far, IRMA has performed 8 audits on Anglo American mines. And just last month, the group released results of the first audits done on South African mines, Anglo American's Amandelbult and Mototolo copper mines. Amandelbult received a 50 out of 100 rating on its performance against IRMA's best practices on social and environmental standards. Mototolo received a 75.
At Amandelbult, we found that we are doing really well in some topics around emergency preparedness and response, our approach to fair labor in terms of work, and in the environmental space, our air quality was one of our key areas of strength. If I turn to Mototolo, Mototolo was strong on waste and materials management. Also, like Amandelbult, fair labor in terms of work was one of our strong chapters, and occupational health and safety.
The mines, though, did fall short on critical issues.
Starting with Mototolo, we are going to be looking at our efforts towards noise and vibration, greenhouse gas emissions. At Amandelbult, we're going to be focusing on our water management, given some areas that were identified in the report, and we'll also like to focus on biodiversity side and community and stakeholder engagement.
More specifically, the audit found that the mines did not fully meet standards in several areas, including prohibiting bribery and corruption, mitigating risks to community health, and mitigating adverse environmental impacts from mining operations. By the way, we have a link to Irma's audits at our website, onpointradio.org. Now, Irma will return to the Anglo-American mines in 18 months for a follow-up. And in 3 years, the mines will be audited again to encourage continuous improvement. And Sarah Mukumbe, the Sustainability Certifications Manager at Anglo American, told us that these audits are not required by national or international law. So mining companies that work with Irma are doing so voluntarily. All right. Well, Amy Boulanger joins us now. She's Executive Director for the Initiative for Responsible Mining Assurance, or IRMA. Amy, welcome to On Point.
Thanks so much for having me.
Okay, so regarding this copper trade-off, tell us more about IRMA and its mission on and how it's trying to really balance or reduce the sense that we have to make a trade-off between the environment and human rights today versus the climate tomorrow.
Well, we know that we're using these materials every day, and we know that there's not a country in the world with laws sufficient to prevent significant harm where mining happens. So the work that IRMA does, creating a voluntary initiative, is never going to be as good as the laws that all companies should follow with legal consequence. But we can, as a voluntary initiative and as one that's equally governed by communities affected by mining and NGOs and workers and their labor unions working with companies, we can move faster and try to create incentives in the world for mining companies to do better right now. Because one thing we know is we already have the technology and the knowledge, the know-how and creative, dedicated people who are in the mining industry as well as their customers. Who know that they can change the way business as usual is done. But we need to create the set of incentives so companies do that and to differentiate between those who are doing harm and those who are changing this business.
So specifically regarding copper, because that's our element of focus today, do you have a sense of sort of what percentage or how many copper mines around the world have and their companies have agreed to work with IRMA for these voluntary audits?
Well, it's amazing because while we're started this conversation 15 years ago, it's still early days for IRMA. It took more than 10 years to get to a sense of confidence in a shared definition of what would be responsible mining. You know, for many people, you look at these materials, it's different from agriculture or forestry or seafood. These are non-renewable materials. Once we dig them out of the earth, they're out. Of course, it gets more renewable if we start to look at things like recycling, circular economy. How do you take these materials and make sure they don't end up in landfills and get them back out there? But so we are only just now beginning the work of encouraging companies to come in, and they're looking at people like Sarah Mukumbe of Anglo American saying, is it going to be worth it? Because the IRMA standard is asking us to do a lot more than what others do, and is that going to change our market value? Is it what the world expects? And some hanging back until they see.
Okay. Michael Weber, let me turn back to you here, because Amy is exactly right about that. I can imagine how hard it was or will continue to be to establish a universally accepted set of standards for mining, especially because the standards from place to place and from nation to nation in which these mines are located vary wildly. So from your engineering perspective here, do you think it's even possible to come up with a sort of an acceptable threshold for all copper mines to meet?
I mean, I do think it's something we should expect is to raise the standard where everyone's using the best industry practices. And so really hats off to that initiative to push people. It's voluntary now, but getting some regulations in place that require people to meet the minimum best practices would be great. And then evolving those practices over time. And by the way, we see the same analog in, say, methane production, natural gas production, where there are some best standards about avoiding methane emissions, and not everyone complies, but we need to do the same thing in other industries. I think this is an important push, and it certainly can get better, and it should get better. And then having a market piece beyond the regulatory piece, where the markets reward you for better behavior, as you heard the other guest say around the differentiation. If you are a differentiated, better behaving mine with less pollution, you should be rewarded for that in the markets with a higher price point where you can sell for more or make more profit. So getting the markets and policies aligned around better behaviors, I think, is absolutely the way to go. We have to do that.
Okay,
and it's possible.
Oh, sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you there. But Amy, this is a really interesting point, and I would love you to explain further. How would that market differentiation happen in terms of, like, let's say the copper mines that are going through these audits, at what point in time in the process of getting the copper from the mine into, I don't know, I'm looking at my phone here on my desk, into a phone, would that differentiation take place in the market?
Well, it used to be incredibly difficult because, and part of the reason why most people aren't thinking as much about mining, even if they're thinking about where does their stuff come from, where does my food come from, my water, my electricity, and how can I be a good citizen in that awareness, is that mining has been so far away from the end consumer. You know, if you go buy your banana, it still looks like a banana at store, which is what it looked like when it left the plantation. But your phone, just like you're saying, doesn't look like that open pit mine that Professor Weber spoke to. But, and that would be because there might be 5 or 10 points in the supply chain from the mine until it gets to your phone, or even more. But what is increasingly happening now is you've got supply chain shortening for a whole range of these materials. And why? In part because the demand for a set of them has gone up dramatically for energy transition. It's also because you've got governments increasingly requiring that the end brands that we buy our things from use their influence and the tremendous purchasing power they have to reach up that supply chain and demand better practices and reduced harm in their supply chains. You've got the fact that you've had a series of disasters at large scale mines, and that communities are saying enough. And together, these things are creating a confluence of demand.
Well, when we come back from this quick break, we're going to take a close look at one of those communities in the United States that has actually, again, done this like workaround regarding the slowness of even regulation in the United States to come up with better agreements with the mines that are operating on their lands. So that's what we'll do in just a moment in episode 2 of our special series, Elements of Energy, today looking at the copper trade-off. This is On Point.
Three decades ago, Sterling Cunio was an angry, violent teenager facing life without parole. Today, he's a celebrated author and a peacemaker. His journey is a window into how violence is perpetuated in this country, but it's also a story about how people change.
There's no better example of a person who's prepared to be released.
And about people changing the system.
We have to reimagine what we're doing, because what we're doing isn't working.
This is Cell Blocks to Mountaintops, a podcast and video series. Subscribe now wherever you get your podcasts.
You're back with On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and it's episode 2 of our special series, Elements of Energy. Today, we're looking at the copper trade-off. The Stillwater River flows across southern Montana. It runs along the Beartooth Mountains, flowing east. Locals and tourists alike come to the Stillwater for kayaking, rafting, and trout fishing. Also close to the river in Nye, Montana, the Stillwater Mine. The mine is owned by the Sibanye Stillwater Company. More than 1,500 employees work to pull copper, nickel, platinum, and palladium out of the ground.
My name is Tyler Martin. I work for Sibanye-Stillwater at the MET Complex. We just sampled a con truck coming down from Nye. We take a core sample, a representative sample of the full depth of the material in the truck. Then we emptied the truck into the bunker. We use a sledgehammer to knock out the remaining material in the bed.
Those raw materials are then transported 40 miles east to Columbus, Montana, for extraction. Heather McDowell, also of Sibanye-Stillwater, explains the process from there.
This is a pretty simple process. We really take the mine material that just looks like a dirt, we dry it out, and we put it inside our smelter, which just heats it up to temperatures at about 3,500 degrees, and that's really all it takes to sort out the precious metals.
The process produces waste at almost every step. Initial mining disposal, tailings, slag, smelting. But at the Sibanye-Stillwater mine,
we emitted less than half a ton of sulfur dioxide last year. We believe we're one of the best pollution-controlled smelters in the world.
That's the mine's environmental manager, Kevin Mitchum. For comparison, the company's environmental permit allows the smelter to emit up to 84 tons of sulfur dioxide per year. It's emitting 99.4% less than that. Sibanye-Stillwater's emissions reduction efforts began a couple of decades ago, May 8th, 2000.
There's a saying that's gone on in our group when we talk to people is that the Good Neighbor Agreement was born out of conflict. It was born out of a lawsuit.
Paul Hawks is a retired Montana rancher and one of the architects of the so-called Good Neighbor Agreement, a legally binding contract between Sibanye-Stillwater Mining Company, the Northern Plains Resource Council, and local community organizations. The agreement's goal is to protect natural landscapes, rural quality of life, and minerals development. And Hawks is talking about a 1992 lawsuit against the state of Montana brought by local environmental groups, including the Northern Plains Resource Council. Back then, the state had issued Sibanye-Stillwater a new permit to expand operations. The permit included a notable provision. It allowed the mine to disregard a key element of Montana's Water Quality Act, meaning the pristine rivers nearby, like the Stillwater, wouldn't be protected.
And frankly, it all came down to water. Our interest was the water there and making sure it stayed clean. It's not enough to just have a water quality law that isn't enforced until it's violated. We didn't want that. We wanted our pristine waters kept pristine.
But in 1995, the state legislature weakened Montana's Water Quality Act, rendering the group's lawsuit moot.
And so we had the option to sue again or to approach the company and see if we could sit down and come to some sort of agreement on our issues. And we decided to see if they would be interested in sitting down and discussing a potential good neighbor agreement.
Sibanye-Stillwater said yes. Hawks says community and environmental groups were realistic about the challenges they faced negotiating with a well-resourced corporation. So they raised funds to hire one of the United States' most celebrated negotiators, Jim Thomas, a Washington attorney who served on the U.S. team that negotiated the Intermediate Nuclear Forces Treaty with the former Soviet Union. But before the lawyers sat face to face, Paul Hawks says his groups asked to first meet alone with Sibanye-Stillwater leadership.
We wanted to sit down with the company, and we wanted the people who could make decisions to be there, their top three people to be there. We banned having any lawyers in the room from either side. So these were just neighbors talking neighbors, and we didn't want the old good guy, bad guy cop thing about having to go back and talk to the boss. We wanted the boss in the room.
Formal negotiations went on for about a year, covering water quality, mine tailings disposal, emissions, even traffic mitigation. Sibanye-Stillwater was willing to meet most of the community's demands, with one condition. Residents and activists would give up the right to sue over any new permits. Hawks says they agreed.
We did, so therefore we had to have something in our agreement that gave it some teeth, that gave us some power, should they not meet the standards. And that took some time to come up with that. What we ended up doing was setting up a system of dispute within the agreement and an arbitration panel.
The final binding agreement was signed on May 8, 2000. It continues to be refined. Today, the contract is more than 200 pages long. It requires the mine to uphold water quality standards three times stronger than the state standards, including a mandatory monitoring system to ensure standards are being met. It also has rules on disposing tailings and traffic mitigation with hundreds of new workers on site. Heather McDowell from Sibanye-Stillwater Mining says the agreement has also been a win for the company.
We haven't had to ever invoke the dispute resolution mechanisms in the Good Neighbor Agreement. And really, I think from a company perspective, perhaps the more amazing statistic is that we've actually had no environmental litigation since the Good Neighbor Agreement was signed, which is, you know, really just amazing.
McDowell adds that though the agreement comes at a hefty cost for the company, it's led to even more valuable benefits.
It allows us to solve a lot of problems before they happen. And I think it also gives us some certainty. Where we have questions about what technology might be best or what the community, you know, what might be the best decision for 10 years from now, we have a group who really is watchdogging us to present that issue to. And sometimes it gives you a whole different viewpoint. I can think of a number of projects where we would have never thought of some great technology or an activity that we did or didn't do because we had that opposing viewpoint.
You know, it's still a mine.
Again, Paul Hawks.
And mine has waste issues. It has tailings and it has things that get into the water. So I'm not going to say it's as pristine as if a mine were not there. But I do have to say that this is probably one of the best mines that I've seen of this way. And that's something that probably would not have happened without our agreement.
That was Paul Hawks, a retired rancher from Sweetgrass County, Montana. Well, let me turn back to Amy Boulanger. She's executive director of the Initiative for Responsible Mining Assurance, or IRMA. And Amy, the example from Montana is a very, very compelling one, in that a community worked together with a mine to come up with a mutually agreeable solution for how to run the operations there. But as you know, there are many, particularly environmental groups, that look at these kind of community agreements and the audits that IRMA performs and just calls them pure greenwashing, that the idea of any kind of, quote, responsible mining is laughable on its face to begin with. I mean, how do you respond to that?
Well, I was one of those people for a long time. I was very skeptical that this work could be done. And I thought if it's voluntary, no company is going to do it unless they think they can control it and greenwash it. However, we are all using these materials. There are thousands of communities around the world living with mining today. They deserve an opportunity to have more information, to have agreements like the Good Neighbor Agreement. And as your whole premise of your show, we're going to be using more of these materials for energy transition, and it's absolutely essential we do this energy transition. And so how can we say, as Paul Hawks did so articulately, like, if we're going to live with these things, how can we ensure that our solutions for the climate crisis don't themselves do more harm? And so many communities, especially in the United States, are criticized for asking for that less harm, for asking to protect the water better, to asking to protect biodiversity, to address issues like noise. But and they get told if you complain, it's just going to squish these impacts off to some other country in the world and the communities who are less able to complain. Well, if we hold a consistent global standard that expects best practice, whether you're in South Africa or Zimbabwe, in Chile, in Russia, in Nevada, in Montana, there's no argument that you shouldn't complain because we're going to expect there to be best practices no matter where this industry operates.
Michael Weber, I'm going to come back to you in just a second. But Amy, I mean, I grant that we live in a world of absolutist thinking, right? In thinking about this copper trade-off, it's very natural for people to be binary in their approach to it, right? Like either we don't use copper at all to preserve the lands and the people that live near and on the places that will be mined, you know, or we just kind of have to grin and bear it and accept the fact that there will be environmental and human damage in order so that we can have this like protected climate in the future. But you mentioned one way around maybe having less of a controversial view of this trade-off, and that is achieving somehow global standards for copper mining. Is anything like that in the works, or is that even just kind of an unimaginable prospect?
Oh, no, it's already here. I mean, the IRMA standard for responsible mining is a global standard that has more than 400 requirements, and you can use it for copper, but you can also use it for lithium and cobalt and rare earths and gold and diamonds. So materials associated with energy transition or other materials that we use every day.
But that's volunteer, right? And I guess what I'm saying is that, you know, in order to achieve true global standards that's acted upon, do you need more? Do you need international treaties or global agreements?
For sure. We'd love to see the IRMA standard become a model and a template for international institutions, whether you have the UN or governments around the world, to basically cut and paste and make it their own. And I think the more that the market rewards companies who do this, the more they'll do that, because they'll see this is the status quo. We've already changed how the world of mining is done.
Because it seems like, you know, again, to be just kind of frank on how systems work, that, you know, all applause goes to the companies, the mining companies that have agreed to work with IRMA, but there are still many others that don't. I mean, I'm thinking back to our initial story about Cobre Panama and First Quantum mining there and basically getting these like very quick and favorable backroom agreements with the government of Panama. And so it took the people of Panama weeks of protest to really have it register with their leadership that this was not going to be acceptable. So Professor Weber, I mean, I guess this gets to something fundamental about how the universe works. I understand you teach thermodynamics, right?
Correct.
So you can't create energy, you can't destroy it. In other words, nothing comes for free. I mean, how do you think through the copper trade-off tension then?
Yeah, the second law of thermodynamics, which is entropy or chaos increases, teaches that there's always a downside impact from everything we do. And we call it entropy or chaos, but that's another expression for environmental impact. And so we have to keep that in mind. And by the way, I love everything Amy says and she's doing, because she really shows what's possible, that we can do it better, and making that better is great. But the other point she said, and other people in the segment have talked about, is you can only make it better. You can't make it perfect, right? And that's the challenge. But for every copper mine we turn on or open, there's another coal mine somewhere else we turn off or close. That's the trade-off. And if we look at fossil fuels, we extract about 15,000 million tons a year of coal, oil, and gas. And if you look at the energy transition at its peak a decade from now, we might need 400 million tons of copper and aluminum and graphite and other things like that. About 100 million of that will be copper. So we can maybe turn off 15,000 million tons of coal, oil, and gas extraction by turning on 400 million tons of these metals extraction. So that's a trade-off I'm willing to take, because that's still like two or three orders of magnitude improvement, significant improvement of reduced mining elsewhere. Now, that isn't very soothing to the people next door to the copper mine, right? They don't live next door to the coal mine, but it is a huge benefit somewhere else. And that's the hard part as a community globally to figure out, is making sure that the people who benefit from the decisions are doing so at great expense to the people who are suffering the disbenefit.
It doesn't just have to be mined out of the ground, though, right? I mean, copper is recyclable.
Oh, recycling is key. Like, so first of all, using it more efficiently, using less for our batteries and everything else. So as prices go up, we have a motivation to use less copper. Finding alternatives that are either better or cheaper or less impactful to produce. Recycling what we have for sure, and copper is very recyclable, which is great. And someday I wonder about urban mining, like mining copper from landfills or other places. We're not there yet, but there are a few places where that's happening at small scale. But we have other things to do rather than just sort of mining for the virgin copper, but we'll need that as well.
So, Amy, we've only got a minute left, unfortunately. Copper is so interesting. We could talk about it for many, many hours. But I'm thinking back to the United States, you know, and our green energy goals here. The U.S. is still a net copper importer. In terms of those market forces, do you think the U.S. government, the federal government, the Biden administration could do more to use the government's power to apply market pressures to balance that copper trade-off, since we're bringing so much into the country?
The government can do so much right now. I mean, they can both incentivize better practice. They can change the 1872 mining law in the United States, which currently creates such a division between communities who are affected and mining companies who come in. If there's a greater sense that the landscapes and indigenous culture, biodiversity, clean water will be protected here in the U.S. when mining happens, then you'll have more companies feeling open, the way Paul Hawk spoke of in Montana. But they can also influence what happens around the world. As the U.S. will continue to import materials from other places, what expectations is it putting on that as its own purchasing, and as it increasingly becomes an investor in those materials around the world, what expectations does it put on how practices are going to happen, whether they are in the Congo or Chile or right here in the U.S.?
Well, Amy Boulanger, Executive Director of the Initiative for Responsible Mining Assurance, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
And Michael Weber at the University of Texas at Austin, thank you.
Thank you.
Well, that was the copper trade-off. Coming up in episode 3 of our special series, we'll talk about the human cost of cobalt mining.
There are hundreds of thousands of people, including tens of thousands of children, whose only means of survival is to engage in extremely hazardous labor digging for cobalt.
Congo, cobalt, and modern slavery around mining. That's episode 3 of our special series, Elements of Energy, Mining for a Green Future. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from BU Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes.
ESG, or environmental social governance, challenges businesses to think beyond the immediate bottom line. But before ESG, the balanced scorecard did something similar. Questrom's Eddie Riedel explains.
The big thing that was groundbreaking about the balanced scorecard is really this idea to move beyond thinking about financial statements, which everybody had thought about since the 1920s, right? That was kind of the gold standard for how to evaluate a company and its performance. And the balanced scorecard's big insight, I think, was to get companies internally to think about, well, what if you don't just focus on financial measures? There are other things that are going to affect your performance, and maybe they won't affect them today, but they're going to affect them in the short term, midterm, long term. Building in those other criteria, those other dimensions, and explicitly linking that to your strategy, to how your company is going to operate, what kind of big decisions it's going to make, that's really what the big insight of the balanced scorecard was meant to do. And at the time, right now, it doesn't seem particularly revolutionary. It seems kind of obvious. We've been stuck in the ESG movement for a while, and thinking about linking these things to corporate strategy seems pretty obvious. At the time, it was a pretty big whoa kind of moment.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.